Good morning. The first case set for argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Todd Stevens. Donald McCarty is present, will be arguing on behalf of Mr. Stevens. Stacia Jackson is also present on behalf of the defendant. Stephen Gamar is present, will be arguing on behalf of the State of South Dakota. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then Mr. McCarty, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. So, Mr. McCarty, you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, as indicated by Chief Justice Jensen, my name is Don McCarty, and I've been appointed to represent Todd Stevens in this appeal to the court, along with Stacia Jackson. And we appreciate your time today. In terms of procedural history, this case was tried to a jury, a judgment and conviction was entered, and we, once we were appointed as counsel, filed a notice of appeal with this court, and we've submitted the briefs that come along with that. Standard of review based on the circumstances is going to be either plain error or ineffective assistance of counsel, and the court's familiar with both of those standards more so than even I. The facts of this case justify me touching on them before I get into some of the procedural argument. And to give the court, whenever I get involved in a file, and actually in this particular file, I thought consciously of this court, when I'm trying to figure out a record that somebody else created and then making decisions about how you address it and how you assess it, it is a difficult situation. In the facts, I would point out to the court that this investigation began in June of 2021. The end of August 2021, Ashley Burgers leaves the house that's the subject of this case. September 26, Paul Schlimmer is stopped by Highway Patrol. September 27th, the search warrant is executed on Todd Stevens' residence, and he's arrested. October 8th, a grand jury is convened and an indictment returned. August 15th, 2022, Ashley Burgers signs an immunity agreement. 3 days later, this case goes to trial. So those are kind of, in my mind, your critical issues, a critical timeline in terms of the facts of this case. And they're important once you start to look at what really happened in this particular case. In June of 2021, allegedly, because we don't know this because it's hearsay, a confidential informant gave Dana Rogers, a detective in Brookings, information regarding Todd Stevens and his involvement in drugs, allegedly. Again, Paul Schlimmer, or this confidential informant, never testified at trial. Prior to that point, Dana Rogers knew nothing about Todd Stevens. He had no criminal history of any kind. They didn't have any understanding that he may be involved in drug activity in Brookings. But based on that tip, he begins to engage in an investigation. Starts at that time frame in June and goes for about 3 months. During that investigation, he does visual surveillance, electronic surveillance, captures cell phone information, trash pulls, and stops people after they leave this residence. None of those things lead to any, they lead to circumstantial evidence that there may be drug use going on, but it doesn't lead to evidence of any kind of distribution, and in particular, any distribution out of that house. They also discovered during that surveillance that Ashley Burgers is living in that house, and she ultimately leaves at the end of August. She's on parole, and they immediately have Ashley Burgers arrested and held. Based on a parole violation. Then it kind of goes silent with regard to Ashley Burgers. They continue to surveil the place, and as I indicated, September 26, Paul Schlimmer gets arrested or pulled over because he's leaving the residence. He doesn't get pulled over by Dana Rogers. He gets pulled over by a highway patrolman. And again, I'm saying this allegedly because the highway patrolman didn't come to testify that, as to what happened on the stop with regard to Paul Schlimmer. Dana Rogers testifies that that stop takes place. That's on September 26. The next day, September 27, they execute the search warrant on the house. They find a little bit of meth in the house. They find marijuana in the house. They find some paraphernalia in the house. They think my client is at the house. He's not, but they're tracking his cell phone, so they stop him as he comes into town, and he has methamphetamine on his person. All right? That's all on September 27th. They arrest him, and then on October 8th, they take this thing to an indictment, to a grand jury. At the grand jury, on the grand jury indictment, that's a transcript that's part of the record, Dana Rogers testifies that the distribution, which is count one of this indictment, is a distribution to Paul Schlimmer. He identifies him by name, and it's a distribution to Paul Schlimmer. And that distribution under count one is also the distribution that triggers count two, which is the distribution in the school zone. Paul Schlimmer never testifies at trial. Never testifies at trial. That indictment comes back. Distribution in a school zone for count two. Possession with intent to distribute based on them stopping him and him having that possession, that methamphetamine on him. And counts four, five, and six, which are keeping a place where drugs are used, possession of another count of possession of meth, and a count of possession of marijuana. At trial, then Todd Stevens gets trial counsel. They withdraw. Trial counsel that took this case to the jury trial gets in the summer of 2022. The record is devoid of any action on the file. This thing gets ready to go to trial. It's set for August 17th, and on August 15th, the state signs an immunity agreement with Ashley Burgers. I would say to this court that the state knew it had no case on August 15th. That's why they had to go get the immunity agreement from Ashley Burgers, and that's why when they went to trial, it was her testimony only and Dana Rogers' testimony with regard to this case.
But you haven't challenged the sufficiency of the evidence.
I agree, but I would say, Justice Salter, that the sufficiency of the evidence is the corroboration issue. And yeah. I think it's particularly important on the corroboration issue when the instruction on the accomplice is never given.
So you've challenged and alleged an abuse of discretion for not giving the cautionary instruction and the accomplice testimony instruction. Would you agree, though, that if there were, and if the record reveals sufficient corroboration for Ms. Berger's accomplice testimony, there could be no error or abuse of discretion for failing to give those two instructions? Because if corroboration appears in the record, not giving the instructions would not be consequential.
I would say back to you, Justice Salter, that I have thoroughly researched the issue, and you folks may prove me wrong. I find no case in the state of South Dakota where those two instructions are not given when an accomplice testifies, and that case is appealed to this court where that conviction has not been reversed.
But what's the error? So the statute 23A.22.8 says that you can't convict somebody based upon an accomplice's testimony unless there's corroboration. The statute doesn't say, Judge, you've got to give a cautionary instruction and you've got to give an accomplice instruction. It says the conviction can't be sustained if there's not corroboration. If this record contains corroboration, that would seem to satisfy the statute.
It may appear to satisfy the statute, but it violates the it establishes ineffective assistance of counsel because it negates a defense. There is more than one case from this court and from the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals that says, if we know it's an accessory, or if there's a factual question as to whether it's an accessory, the instructions must be given, and failing to give the instructions negates the defense, and therefore you have a fundamental unfairness, the prejudice, and the case must be reversed.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, but you don't even have to get to ineffective assistance. Your allegation is this is plain error. We've got these cases in South Dakota along with the statute that says you got to give these instructions, and if you don't, it's erroneous, and that rises to the level of plain error. That's really your argument, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And I think what happens is that those cases that talk about corroboration get confused with a case like this. The corroboration cases are cases where one of these instructions or both of these instructions may have been given, and then somebody appeals as to whether the corroboration was sufficient. The cases where those instructions are not given are the plain error cases.
But then is there a distinction in our cases between the corroboration instruction and what we've said in those cases and the cautionary instruction where we've said if requested, you got to give it, and if you don't, it's reversible error? Is there a case in South Dakota that you found that says you don't give a cautionary instruction, it's error whether it's requested or not, and the court abuses its discretion in not giving a cautionary instruction if it's not requested?
The cases in South Dakota that are on point are State v. Thomas, State v. Bean, Freeman v. Class, Grooms v. State, and State v. McBride. And those cases are the ones that I'm referring to, that when these instructions are not given, it is reversed. There is no case on the opposite side where these instructions are not given, but the court says corroboration was good enough, we're going to affirm the conviction. That case doesn't exist in the state of South Dakota.
Regardless of whether or not the client is prejudiced, I mean, that takes us to prong 3 and 4 of plain air. Can you address, the bottom line is if there's corroboration in this record, is your client prejudiced?
The problem with that, Justice Kern, is this, that when you don't give the accessory instruction in the first place, the jury never gets an opportunity to properly assess the accessory. That instruction on accessory says, this witness is suspect. You should look very closely at this, and this is not a witness that you should consider like the other instruction says, that all witnesses are equal when they sit down. So the cases say that by failing to request the instruction on accessory or failing to give the instruction on accessory, you negate the defense and you eliminate the ability for them to put on the defense, because the jury never properly assessed the accessory. It never happened. And so when this comes up on appeal, then the court has to completely take the position of the jury to make a decision that the jury never considered. Now, if I'm wrong on that issue and this court says he's wrong, it doesn't just negate the defense, you still have to show the prejudice factually. I would point you to Thomas, the press box case down in Sioux Falls. They said under that standard, when you're looking at the prejudice, you would say eliminate the accomplice's testimony. And could the defendant have been convicted with that testimony being out? Because the jury never properly assessed it, and the improper instruction was never given.
Seems like you're according it basically structural error status. You're presuming that and I'm not quarreling with you, but I mean,
I got it.
The argument kind of presumes that what you have said, which is that the jury was unenlightened as to the inherent bias that exists. By the way, instruction 26 talked about bias, right? I know your argument is that's not good enough, but that instruction was there, that argument was there, the immunity and the inherent bias that comes with it was laid bare. How can we be so sure as a sort of a presumptive matter that, as you say, the jury couldn't or didn't, and so much so that we're willing to just take that as an article of faith, assess this evidence correctly?
The language I'm giving you from Thomas is this court's language that says, when you analyze the situation under these circumstances, remove her testimony, and could he be convicted? That's what the case says. And so I think that is a reasonable way to assess it when the accessory instruction is not given. Even if you assess it under just a standard, it was their prejudice. There was prejudice in this case. There is no question. No other witness testified. I don't know that anybody sitting here after a thorough review of this record could testify who the distribution was to. Ashley Burgers doesn't identify Paul Schlimmer, who the indictment is based on, and Dana Rogers doesn't ever make reference to any of the potential distributions referenced by the accessory. It was clearly prejudice. Even if you get to the point of applying a prejudice. And again, I don't believe it applies when the accessory instruction is not given. Thomas, Bean, Class, Grooms, and McBride stand for that purpose. And if this court affirms this conviction, you will be establishing new law that this case can survive under those circumstances. I would also point out, one of the cases cited by both counsel is Corrine, which is a case out of Rapid City. And that case makes clear also that if it's a question of fact as to whether it's an accessory, the accessory instruction has to be given. And then once that hurdle is met, all of these things are triggered. Also, I would point out to the court, just a basic review of the record demonstrates that not only did you have the failure to request these crucial instructions, there was a full and complete failure to defend the case at the time of trial. No objections, no motion practice, no attack on the accomplice, no challenge to hearsay.
Your time's up, Mr. McCarty.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Gaymeyer, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. None of the accomplice jury instructions that Stevens now requests for the very first time on appeal were needed at trial. This is because Ashley Burgers was not an accomplice to Todd Stevens. And further, defense counsel's strategy at trial was to call Burgers the one drug dealer in that case and argue that Stevens was not at all involved in the dealing. Thus, Burgers is not an accomplice. To render Burgers an accomplice, Busack instructs that she has to be one who is liable to prosecution for the identical offenses charged against the defendant on trial. In addition, she must have in some manner, knowingly and with criminal intent, participated, associated, or concurred with another in the commission of a crime. And a review of Berger's testimony shows that she would not be liable to prosecution for the identical acts of the relevant offenses in this case, which are the distribution of methamphetamine offense and the possession with intent to distribute. Berger's testified that Stevens distributed directly to her. And for at least those acts, she cannot be an accomplice, as this court has held that a purchaser of illegal drugs, purchaser or those who receive illegal drugs are not accomplices to the crime of distribution. She further testified that she saw Todd Stevens distributing meth to his friends, and she testified to this multiple times. She confirmed that it was Todd Stevens who supplied the meth to this group of people. She confirmed that it was Todd Stevens who would weigh it on his digital scale, and that Stevens was the one who made the distribution and took the money. Burgers merely saw this happen.
Counsel, is there a factual showing in the record regarding this distribution for count one to Paul Schlimmer? That was just argued by Mr. McCarthy. Mm-hmm.
Could you address that? So the indictment itself did not make reference to Paul Schlimmer. The indictment itself was open. It just said that Stevens knowingly distributed methamphetamine to another person. So in that case, the jury would be able to find any of the acts that Berger has testified to for that distribution count.
So then doesn't that bring Berger in as an accomplice? Because she talked about going and getting the meth and distributing it to others, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. There is testimony from Burgers that she did distribute meth to Roger Love, but that is a separate and distinct act from what Todd Stevens was doing, because in this particular instance, Todd Stevens had been passed out from a drug bender, and Burgers at trial was not able to answer the question of whether Todd Stevens knew Burgers was going to make that distribution. This distribution was a separate act that was done solely by Ashley Burgers.
I thought the note from the trash pool said, I'm gonna get rid of this half of the full for you.
That is what the note said, but The fact remains that Stevens did not know it, and at trial, his counsel accused Burgers of stealing that meth from Todd Stevens. So to me, that doesn't sound like they were working with that together. And Busack has instructed that an act that similar misconduct that you could be charged with under the same statute does not mean that that does not mean that you're an accomplice, because Burgers still did not commit the identical offenses that Stevens could be found guilty of with that.
For the benefit of argument, assume that that we treat her as an accomplice. Now tell me your viewpoint on the case.
Okay, so with that, the state still wins, because for two reasons. Number one, Stevens still cannot show a reasonable probability that the outcome in this case would have been different had that jury instruction been given. Had the jury instructions been given and Burgers considered an accomplice. Because unlike, in contrast with this court's past precedent, there is sufficient corroboration in the record to corroborate Burgers' testimony. And this court has said that both circumstantial evidence as well as the accused's own words can provide the necessary corroboration. And in this case, Todd Stevens admits to distributing methamphetamine to his friends.
Mr. McCarty argued that Thomas tells us that when we are assessing for plain error and we're addressing prejudice, that we should then exclude all of the evidence that the accomplice provided and assess the evidence there to determine whether there was prejudice. Is that your reading of Thomas?
I would say that would not be my reading of Thomas. I think the standard would be, this court would be to look at whether the evidence in the record is still able to corroborate the witness's testimony, because at the end of the day, that witness...
Which evidence in the record? Do we exclude all of the accomplice testimony? Because that's the assertion that he has made, is that that's how we should assess prejudice, is exclude all of the accomplice testimony.
I would say for assessing prejudice, it would be whether the accomplice testimony in the record was corroborated, so looking at the accomplice testimony as well as the rest of the evidence. And that rest of the evidence shows with Todd Stevens texting his son from jail, and he said, "As much as I bought meth, I also helped other friends, and we just paid each other back the cost. If that is considered being a distributor, then I guess I and all the past friends are dealers then. But I will say it's BS to tag me or any other as a dealer when the real ones have pounds or more available."
Let me ask you it like this. If you exclude Burger's testimony, do you think there's sufficient evidence in the record to have convicted Stevens?
Yes, I think there
and
is.
What would you base that on?
For one, his direct admission to distributing methamphetamine to his friends. And I think that is a direct admission, and Detective Dana Rogers did have a 3-month investigation here. He's a 7-year veteran of narcotics cases. That's his specialty. And he did find evidence that was indicative of distribution as well. So he searched Stevens' house towards the end of that investigation, and he found a digital scale, a spork, and a measuring spoon, all which had methamphetamine white residue on it, and the desk around that tested positive for methamphetamine. And Detective Rogers, in his experience, said that this type of equipment is indicative of drug distribution. Further, Detective Rogers also tracked Stevens via his cell phone on multiple occasions, at least twice, down to within 2 blocks of a known drug dealer in Sioux Falls. In addition, he found various drug paraphernalia around Todd Stevens' house, as well as drug paraphernalia from Todd Stevens' trash, methamphetamine on Todd Stevens when he was arrested. And in Todd Stevens' house, they found a small quantity of methamphetamine under his mattress. So there is more than sufficient corroboration more than sufficient evidence in the record to sustain a conviction if Burgers' testimony were to be excluded here. And further, I would just like to go back, a second that even though Stevens now argues on appeal that Burgers was an accomplice, that was not the approach that Stevens' trial counsel took down below. In fact, it's from the record, Stephen's trial counsel strategy was to call Ashley Burgers the dealer and try to distance Todd Stevens from those distribution charges. Because down below, the state had Stevens dead to rights on his drug possession charges. They're not contested here today, and at trial, trial counsel told the jury that the state met their burden on those. So his strategy was to get Stevens away from the distribution charges and to get him off of those. And to do that, his strategy was to call Ashley Burgers the dealer in this case. He develops this on opening, mentioning that Burgers stole meth so she could sell it and that Stevens was not involved in distribution. And in closing, he kind of develops these points on cross, again trying to get out from Burgers that she did steal meth from Todd Stevens. And in closing, says that Burgers was the dealer. She was the one distributing meth from Stevens' home. In addition, argued that it didn't make any sense for Burgers, who had testified she was trying to get sober, to move in with somebody dealing methamphetamine. And with this strategy, he could not explicitly ask for an accomplice instruction because it would blow his whole strategy up. And even though he could not ask for those instructions, he still brought out Burgers' bias on cross and in closing. He got out the fact that she had children, and it would be difficult to care for those children while she was in jail. He tried to elicit, that Burgers had stolen meth from Stevens to distribute, and also brought up her immunity agreement that she got from the state, where she wouldn't be charged with certain things for testifying. So here, he tried to have the best of both worlds. Calling Burgers the dealer, distancing his own client from those distribution charges, while at the same time still bringing out why she could be a biased and untrustworthy witness. And in looking at an ineffective assistance claim, this court does note that there are a wide range of acceptable professional performances here. And just because a trial strategy results in a guilty verdict does not mean that that trial strategy was ineffective.
So the statute requires the judge to give instructions when the accomplice testimony is given. Can you point us to any case in South Dakota where the judge has not given an accomplice instruction and the cautionary instruction, and we haven't reversed?
So, Your Honor, this court, I don't believe, has held in the cases specifically that that it is reversible error for a trial court to sua sponte fail to give certain accomplice instructions. In addition, in contrast with this court's previous precedent, I'm not sure there has been a case where defense counsel's trial strategy has been brought up, where he's tried to call the accomplice witness the dealer in this case, and you can't have someone be the dealer and also be an accomplice to your client, who you're trying to say was not involved with the dealing. I don't know if there has been, at least in my research, I have not found a case where that dynamic was present. And I would say that this court should decline to address Stevens' ineffective assistance of counsel claims for two reasons. Number one, that we don't know trial counsel's motivations for partaking with the strategy down below, and that would be something that would need to be fleshed out. And also, that from his strategy, it's clear from the record that this was not one of those cases where there was a manifest usurpation of Stevens' constitutional rights. And in conclusion, I would say that Ashley Burgers was not an accomplice, and the record does show that defense counsel chose to pursue an argument that Burgers was the dealer in this case, so she could not be an accomplice. The state requests this court affirm the counts 1, 2, and 3 of the judgment of conviction, the counts at issue here today. And if this court has no further questions, I would yield the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Gamer.
Thank you.
Mr. Carney, you can proceed with your rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Justice Stevens. Jensen, page 11 of the grand jury transcript,
I agree it's not in the indictment. It doesn't name Paul Schlimmer, which I found surprising that they didn't name who the distribution was to. It's not said in the indictment, but it's said specifically at page 11 of the grand jury transcript. The state's attorney circles back and says, just to be clear, the distribution in count one is Paul Schlimmer. Correct. And that distribution is the distribution that gives rise to the distribution out of the house, and that's how you get the first two counts.
Well, at trial, though, was it clear that it was Schlimmer that they were?
No, they moved away from, I think, Schlimmer.
Yeah. I mean, that was my sense, is that he's distributing in the house, and there wasn't a specific transaction identified. It was multiple transactions.
But again, reading the record in from behind, I think they thought they had Schlimmer to go to trial. Schlimmer must have fell apart for whatever reason, and they shifted to Ashley at the very last minute, got that immunity agreement at the 15th, went to trial on the 17th, and defense counsel froze at the stick.
So there's no motion for a bill of particulars or any sort of indication as to which distribution
there's zero,
the state was pursuing?
There was zero motion practice in an effort to find that out, and there was no effort to continue the trial or get more delineation when the case shifted.
But that's not really in front of us, is it?
It's not. A good reading of the record shows that that's what happened.
Right. And but that issue's not in front of us.
It's not directly in front of this court, but when you combine the failure to give the instructions with how this case was then tried, and you start looking at, was this a fair process? What's the integrity of the court look like? Has the process been true? The answer to that question is absolutely no in this case. It's absolutely no. In response to the questions regarding the standard in Thomas, paragraph 28 says, the question then is, if we take away Broomfield's accomplice testimony, parens, assuming the jury discredited it after having been properly instructed, is there a reasonable probability that the jury would have had a reasonable doubt respecting Thomas's guilt? That's the language that I'm getting to you. And I think I'm not saying to the court that there's not different ways to look at how you parse through the evidence when you have this critical error made at trial. But in Thomas, that was the standard that they applied. And that standard has been applied in other circumstances. And it makes sense because the defendant has been negated from presenting that defense because the instructions were not presented.
Well, and I might challenge you there. Was that a standard in Thomas, or was that more dicta in the sense of looking at the facts of that case outside of what they had from the accessories in that case? They just didn't have any other evidence to support the conviction.
Well,
that's different than factually than this case. Would you agree?
I disagree. I agree with the first part of what you said, which is I don't think it's dicta, but I think it's one way to analyze it when this circumstance arises. And I think that analysis is fair and applicable. I think there, I wouldn't argue with the court necessarily, but there may be under other circumstances other ways to analyze it. But I would also point out in Thomas that the state tried to shift in that case and say, hey, you don't have to look at the accomplice testimony because the defendant in that case had a phone call. This is a reckless burning case. The defendant had a phone call where he says he and these other two guys were out barbecuing and starting a fire, screwing around with this fire, and they started a fire. And then they offered that to say that was an admission. And the court said, hey, wait a second, under these circumstances, that's equivocal. That's not clear on the statement. And if you're going to use that under these circumstances, it can't be equivocal.
Maybe that's just fact-bound to that case.
Well, my point is it applies to this case as well, which is they convicted him of a distribution from the house, and they want to argue that the corroboration, despite all these other errors, is that my client sent a text message and said he helped people out. Again, it's equivocal. And when you put together an accessory case, heavily or entirely dependent on the accessory, you can't just then tie whatever you want to it to then say there's enough evidence. It just shouldn't and doesn't apply that way. I would also again point out to the court, and I think it's clear from reviewing the record, there were numerous errors in addition to the failing to request the instruction. There were, and I want to get this right, defense counsel asked a total of 61 questions on cross-examination. He raised a total of 4 objections. The prosecutor specifically mentioned that the defendant invoked his right to remain silent and refused to give the passcode to his phone.
Your time's up, Mr. McCarty.
Thank you, Justice Jensen, and I would ask that the court reverse this case on the basis set forth in the argument and in my briefs.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.